Hello, good people. Welcome to our show. Hello, bad people. Welcome to our show. I don't want to discriminate bad people. Welcome if you want to learn more about cybersecurity. Welcome, because this episode will bring a lot of valuable insights. I know from personal experience. My websites were hacked 2 times. The first time, I lost the entire business. Yeah, I'm not kidding about that. We lost the entire business because it happened in the best-selling season. That was an online shop. And at that time, we didn't have experience how to recover, what to do. And so, yeah, we couldn't handle all these expenses. We had a lot of products that nobody needed after holiday season. And the second time was painful as well. So after 3 months, we recovered, but we lost a lot of sales. And all this malware put some settings in WordPress plugins, leave a lot of terrible events, and we spend time on something that we can prevent. That is why today I want to learn more about cybersecurity, because prevention costs a lot less than treatment. You need to know about that. I'm so excited to discuss this topic with Scott Aldrich. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Excited to be here today.
A big pleasure. A big pleasure. I want to learn from experts like you. I know about your great experience. You wrote a book on Amazon. So, by the way, I'm going to read this book. You told a little bit about this book. So it's on my list. I have a huge list of books that I need to read. And I know you're president of IP services. So tell more about your experience and anything that can help to learn more about you.
Yeah, well, thank you. First, I'll say, you know, appreciate your podcast. Really some valuable stuff. I've looked at watched some of the episodes, and would really encourage your audience to tune in. 5-star, you know, good stuff. I really like what you're doing and how you're bringing a lot of really good content to marketers and SEO experts, especially. So good stuff. Thank you. I'm kind of a teenpreneur. I started way back when I was 19 years old. I'm dating myself in software, and basically have, you know, kind of reinvented myself in technology over the years. Back in about the mid 2000s, we kind of launched into some network support, network integration, and what we call MSP, managed services provider, which there wasn't a lot of back in that mid 2000s timeframe. It was pretty far and few between. And so we had kind of re-spun ourselves off and sold off some of my other businesses. Anyway, and so we've been sitting in managed services, which over time has evolved to really a managed security service provider, an MSSP. And really the last 15 years, that's where I've camped. I have worked with security since way back in, again, the late 90s. So we've got a long history of working. We called it IT security. We didn't call it cybersecurity. And of course, as we all know, the world has evolved over that time. I not only been running my own, you know, my own MSSP business for the last 20 years, but specifically have really camped in helping author and be a part of thought leadership and best practices around IT management practices and cybersecurity. And so we had a series of books, the Visible Ops series. I was involved in producing those. And then, of course, more recently just released here, the Visible Ops Cybersecurity Edition, which is part of a series that's sold over about 350,000 copies across the globe. And so it's been widely successful and highly successful, and very excited about it. I do hold an MBA in cybersecurity. I am certified on a variety of different technical things as well, a little more technical than maybe some. It's not all just philosophical. A lot of it is practical, hands-on working and running and advising my own MSSP company and my teams. So that's kind of my background of what I've been involved with, and I'm excited to share a little bit more with you today.
Awesome. Scott, I have my first question about human psychology. You know, I'm interested about that because what a phone book offers usually learn psychology to provide valuable insights. And I'm interested why people like me don't pay for prevention, but will pay everything for treatment. I mean, like, I got this personal experience. That is why today I pay extra attention to security, but I didn't before. So tell about psychology, why it happens like that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it's because a lot of organizations, they don't necessarily see IT systems. It's kind of almost historic in the world of IT and technology. A lot of companies are slow to embrace it. They see it as a cost center. They don't see it as a revenue enabler. They don't see it as strategic. So I think that's kind of where IT's been. And some of that's IT's own fault from mismanagement. Most IT projects, and the studies still prove this to this day, believe it or not, that they tend to come in over budget and not on time. So, you know, they're rolling out some new feature, new software, you know, feature, or new product or new systems or whatever it might be. We're going to migrate some of our stuff to the cloud. Those things continue to this day to be not on time and over budget. So there's a bias, if you will, against, I think, technology and the investment in technology, what that means. And yet we read the news every day. You don't have to look far, right? Every day in the news, we're seeing some kind of a cybersecurity breach. Yeah. And we're seeing it go downstream. It's touching tiny, you know, businesses that might only do $1 million in revenue, which really is not that much in the scope of things. So it's really everybody's a target. And so we have a problem with leadership. And that's one of my first chapters in the book. The first chapter really talks about leadership in cybersecurity and kind of a security first mindset and why we should care and prioritize cybersecurity. And again, the statistics and the numbers are terrible. You just shared some of your own. I mean, 40% of businesses that suffer a serious cybersecurity attack go out of business. So it's that serious. It'll put you out. And so businesses aren't taking that serious. A lot of presidents, owners, executives, not making a priority of it as leadership. They tend to not invest like they should to protect themselves. And then boardrooms are, in the larger, more enterprise business, their boardrooms kind of have their head in the sand too. They're not really understanding it. So they tend to stay away from it, not ask the tough questions of their management teams. And so that's also a big thing, is that a lot of boards now, there's a real move over the last couple of years to get leadership around cybersecurity that sits at the board layer to ask and help govern with the right questions. So it is a problem. And there's a lot more to the psychology of security, more into why do people still click on things and why do they, you know, do bad things unintentionally. But there's more psychology there to think about from the user perspective that the hackers know. They know how to play off of that psychology for the various users that are out there that have access to systems and networks, even IT people.
Yeah. According to some data, online fraud is more than $100 billion a year. It's a lot of money. And it's only online fraud. But can you imagine the damage that you can get? As I got this damage, so it's even more. It's even more. So, Scott, okay, let's imagine someone can listen to this episode and decide to do something with their projects, but have no any experience. For example, if I do anything first, I usually try to learn a little bit more, to spend some time, like a few days to read, to learn, to listen, to watch, anything like that, to get more insights before choose the right people who can help me or right tools. Can you tell where to start? I mean, like, for example, let's imagine someone has project and wanna to put security in the priorities. What to do first?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that's in my book. It really, what it gets into in the later chapters is really what we call a methodology around cybersecurity. And it's becoming very popular. It's been around for quite a while. And it's called Zero Trust. And it really takes the idea of least privilege, which we've known about in various, you know, rolling out domains and security architecture on networks where we only give access and privileges to those that need the access and privilege. So the idea is you take that to every, and Zero Trust are like seven pillars of your IT infrastructure and your networks. And so you look at each one, starting with like identity and access management, all the way down to what something we call micro segmentation. So you're looking at this idea of only giving trust and access to those that absolutely need it. And then often even limiting that for a particular scope. So they have access only for the point in time that they need to have access, which limits what we call the attack surface and the threat landscape. So that attacks, it's harder for them to find or know when and what surface to attack to make a breach or what to happen. One of the principles of Zero Trust is assume breach. And you can tell today, look at all the big companies, enterprises that have all the smart security guys, teams of them paying buku bucks for the best and the brightest. They've got all the best tools. And yet we still see that they're getting hacked. So breached. So we know that there's it's just a matter of time. If the bad guys were to state now where if they really want, the threat actors really want to get you, they can find a way to get you. It's just a matter of time. So we assume breach. And so if we're going to assume breach, we have to go through the exercise of, okay, I just showed up. I've got the black screen. I got the text file that's telling me I need to pay so much crypto because, and they want crypto. They don't want any other currency because they want it non-traceable. And I'm telling me I got to pay a bunch of money in a ransomware attack, which is one of the most popular types of threats that we read about. So if that happened, what would be the best response? The best response would be, no, thank you, threat actor. We're not going to pay you. And we know that we have what we call immutable backups, which are air-gapped. And explaining that, these are backups that are not just streamed to the cloud or to another site, or they're not just backed up on your local system or whatever. These are backups that are backed up. They're scanned for malware. They're scanned for ransomware. They're completely set apart from your network. So we're not talking about, you know, your CIDIP, you know, your pipeline or doing, you know, Chef or Puppet where it's doing little snapshots. You've got to get a complete full backup of all your infrastructure, your data into a place where it can't be touched. And then you need to have a couple of things to consider. Then you got to think about what we call your RPO and your RTO. RPO is your recovery point objective. So when's the last time we snapshotted or streamed our backup? Is it 4 hours, every four? Is it every day? Is it every 2 days? So we need to know what point in time we want to be able to be backed up. And then the other thing is the RTO, which is what is the recovery time? How long will it take us to get our systems back online and stood back up? And some people can suffer a day, some a half a day, some 5 days, some 7 days, depending. So there's different things to consider as you're working on your backup. So I know I'm spending a lot of energy on encouraging people to understand and know backups, as simple as everybody thinks it is. There's a lot of assumption. A lot of people, you know, oh yeah, we're backing up. We're good. We're good. And they told me that they're safe. We need to really know. We need to trust but verify that we have truly immutable backups that we can restore and we have a plan to do it. That's the number one thing to start with first. Secondarily, there are a couple of basic kind of, I would say, necessary cybersecurity defenses that you must have in place. The 80% of all threats or hacks or attacks or breaches come from the end user. So using strong passwords, which usually means you need to use a password manager. And most people don't want to take the time because it's a hassle and it's a pain to have a password manager that basically creates very strong passwords and can very much automate that process. So you need really strong passwords and you should have a tool in place to do that. And then a part of that, you should have MFA, multi-factor authentication. Yeah. Got to be careful about MFA because these days they're figuring out lots of ways to hijack the MFA codes from both your SMS, your text strings and your phones, and from your email. So they call that centralized MFA. You really want a decentralized MFA solution, meaning that it's using some kind of an application on your phone, your mobile phone, because it's actually using crypto. It'll tie to the MAC address of your phone and it'll actually have a crypto key. And then of course the system that you're using with, of course, advanced MFA, it has it. So it's a shared key system that's constantly connecting itself to make sure that your zero trusted access to the network is verified. So MFA at a minimum, and then really advanced MFA is another piece. And then one more thing I would say that's kind of foundational, and that is, there's, rather than the old anti-spam, anti-malware days where we all had the antivirus software and we put the latest on, we run the update because we get a notice that there's new malware out there. And so they play, you know, cat and mouse, who has the better one to protect or defend the latest malware that's been released by the bad actors. Same thing's true of ransomware and some other malicious software that goes out there from clicking on things, which users will tend to do, not just email, but websites, et cetera. So there's this thing called EDR, which is called Endpoint Detection Response. It is the new antivirus. And if you're not using an endpoint detection response, which will arrest about 70% of any bad, you know, malicious activity at the endpoint, it'll basically cut your computer. It'll shut it down, freeze it until it can be eradicated before it crawls. The malware infection goes in deeper to the network. So it protects the rest of your systems because it arrests that threat point where the threat actor is coming in at right at the endpoint, wherever that is. So those are for, you know, desktops and, you know, your endpoint user, your laptops, your Macs, whatever. Those are the big pieces in EDR. Now, there's also the next level is MDR, which is managed detection response. And this is where you're using tools like an EDR that they usually talk to each other. And it's actively looking at all of your network. And when it sees threats happening, it shuts it down again across the whole network. So these are just some of the basic tools. There's a lot more layers as we talk about layers of zero trust. And that really is the best practice in cybersecurity, is adding every layer you can possibly add practically and reasonably, and continuing to evolve your cybersecurity program so that you put yourself in your best defense. So those are just some basic things that I would speak to.
Yeah, nice. You know, I'd like to recover in 3-5 days, but I spent 3 months, you know, to recover from my last attack, because it's not simple just to clean this malware. We developed from the scratch many things, you know. We couldn't find all gaps, you know, flaws. So yeah, guys, it takes a lot more time, you know, in many cases. I don't want to say about all cases, but in many cases, it takes a lot more time. So yeah, Scott, I want to ask about, I took part in many meetings, and many coaches tell don't click links in emails. You know, we use emails every single day. We need to click links from customers, from salespeople. It doesn't matter. We get a lot of links, but many coaches say, no, don't click links, ignore them, be careful about that. Can you tell how to manage the process? If I need to click links, I need to get this data, but how I can be sure that this link is safe for me?
Yeah, so that's basically user education, and we call it SAT, security awareness training. And it really is looking for little details, like on the domain, do you know it's a trusted domain that it's coming from? Sometimes you'll see an extra dot whatever extension of the domain. Somebody's basically phishing or phishing or whatever. So a lot of times I'll send domains or links to click on. And the idea is that really is not the authoritative domain that you think it is. You know, big banks, they'll put a, you know, whatever, wellsfargo.q.com. Or they'll put something, insert something. So you got to really pay attention as to what are the domains that it's coming from. You can't just click on things blindly. The other thing is the EDR I was just talking about. That's also kind of a, you know, a backstop. So that if you do click on a link, good chance it will get stopped and arrested if you're using the right, you know, endpoint detection response software. But that's one thing. And then on emails, same thing. Looking at, you know, suspicious names. If they're creating fake urgency, you know, you just got to stop before just clicking and opening and clicking and opening. You really got to think about, who's this coming from? Does it seem legitimate? And what we've learned a little bit is that some of the security awareness training out there, they're teaching people not to click on bad links by telling them to click on bad links, which is very interesting psychology of training. One of the tools that we use in our MSSP business is more of a, you know, positive reinforcement. It does a short little video. So it's actually teaching you about, as I'm talking about, what to click, what to look for, what not telling you to click on links. And then it gives you a little test, and everybody gets a little certificate, and they get, you know, every, you know, couple of weeks, they get a new one to remind them and keep security first in their organization, making a priority of it, talking about it, having breakout sessions to talk about the latest cybersecurity threats that are out there. Is it that a priority in your company to really make it aware and keep it in front of people and train them what not to click on and what to click on and what looks suspicious and what not? It comes through learning and repetition to learn what to do. Because to your point, you still have to do business. And so there are links and things that are going to be shared. The other thing is HTTPS, which we all kind of know about that. We should know that the domain is actually a secured domain. Not that a secure domain couldn't trick you and hack you, it could, but do we know that if information we're putting into a particular link or whatever, if it's not in a secure, you know, hypertext and terminal protocol, the HTTPS, knowing that it's encrypted, that the site has some level of protection of the data that you're putting in. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, got it, valuable. So John is asking, how should businesses shift their mindset from compliance-based security to risk silence basically cybersecurity?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually, because that's actually almost a book that I've thought about, is, you know, visible ops compliance. Because there is a lot of people that I say organizations, companies, that get confused about checking boxes for compliance. So you can have all the security policies, you can have all the best practice policies, right? The UAPs, user acceptance policies, all the things that you do in your organization. But if you're just doing that to check boxes and there's not any real way to authenticate and actuate those particular policies, Yeah, you're still going to be open with threats. And so you got the idea is we got to move beyond the idea of, oh, do we have this in place? Do we have this in place? This in place? And actually testing, having attestation, if you will, of those controls that you put in that are married to the compliance. The other thing is that a lot of compliance, if you is really good, you embrace it. There's been in the past a little bit of a resistance, like, oh, it's, you know, GLB, you know, whatever, it's, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley, and it's heavy, and it creates a lot of work for IT, and it's expensive. And that's true. But the other thing in this dispensation of, you know, cybersecurity, we really have to embrace the compliance and say, okay, how do we get the best of the best if we're going to take on this particular control? And then not just having a policy and not just saying you check the box that the control's in place, but actually having accountability that those controls are working. So trust but verify, and making sure that whatever tools you're rolling out. And then the other thing is really prioritizing the right things. You'll learn that with certain compliance that if you actually, you know, if you really put them what you call kind of kill chain, and you look at the various sets of controls, whether it's, you know, whatever, whether it's CMMC or it's a PCI or it's HIPAA for healthcare or, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley, you'll find that if you do a lot of the base controls, the main ones, it kind of has a kill chain. It'll knock out most of the other compliance on most of the other controls if you're focusing on the right ones. So yeah, great thing. Resilience is the key. That's where we're moving to. And that's a little bit what I was talking about with the backups, not just checking a box to make sure you have backups, but actually knowing that you've tested, verified, and that they're immutable and they can be restored within a time and point of which you need it to be. That is a resilient position. Now, if companies can afford it, there are ways to actually air gap complete redundant, you know, architectures that are synchronizing with each other. So you literally have real-time failover if something bad happens. But that gets really expensive.
Yeah, yeah. Scott, I'm interested about choosing the right tool. I mean, like, many tools look the same. I mean, like, the same features. All of them have recognition. But can you tell your methods? I mean, like, how to choose a specific tool for a specific case?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are a glut of tools out there. That's a very good point. And I think a lot of them, you know, come down to, you know, looking at what is their, you know, you need to have a strategy first. So if it's zero trust, mm-hmm. we look at things, we kind of come at it from a more of a pragmatic approach. What is our biggest threat? And it's the endpoint, right? The edge of the network is the end user nowadays, as we say, right? They're the new threat. So we want to start at the very edge. We want to look at how do users interface. And so I touched on this earlier. So looking for what we call PAM, which is privileged access management. That's kind of the ultimate in identity and access management, is making sure that we have role-based access and some of the things you do in security. So we start with the very edge, the end user, and training them to be security-minded, and that's really important. And so as I spoke to that, looking for something that's not just having you click on a bunch of bad links, not to click bad links. So look for tools that are actually educating people and rewarding them almost psychologically for, you know, being interested in reading, completing, and understanding something. It gives them a certificate. Woohoo, congratulations, celebration. You passed your, you know, security awareness training. So we start there. And then as we think about identity and access management, we got to think about some of those basic things. How are we accessing the network, and how do we verify that that user, authenticate them, that we know they are who they say they are, which is a really, really important thing. Again, this is the most biggest vulnerability that exists out there at the end user. So you got to spend a lot of energy on that. You're looking for tools that are really at, I would call them tip of the spear. They, like I shared with the MFA, just doing a text MFA or a central MFA that shoots an email, you know, look for ones that actually have dual authentication or crypto authentication, if you will. We call it verified credential access. So it really verifies the credentials to know that you are who you say you are, and it has to have a shared key system. That's really important. So really, again, looking for best practices and looking obviously for references, doing your research to make sure that they can prove that, you know, a lot of the claims that they make around the security of the tool is important. It's layers, tends to be one solution isn't always going to be able to do everything. If they're telling you that buy this one particular tool and we do these, you know, these four things and you don't ever have to worry about cybersecurity again, that there's no way that could be true. So that's an awareness to be, you know, be out there. They may do two or three things really well, but they don't do everything. And there's no one tool. I joke in my book a little bit that a fool with the tool is still a fool. So we don't want to be a fool with the tool just by saying one tool is going to all of a sudden check a box and we're going to have awesome cybersecurity. It takes layers. Yeah. And again, I get into those layers in my book.
Yeah, got it, got it. Scott, I want to ask one very naive question, probably from my side, I don't know, but anyway, I want to ask about that. What is the goal of these hackers, attackers, you know, who try to put down any website or any business? I mean, like, I understand when no Korea hackers can do it. I mean, like, political reasons, super their leader can say, okay, please destroy this West. But what about simple examples? Because, you know, if we check out online studies, it's a lot. I mean, like, plus 30% of all websites are hacked. Mm-hmm. 30%, it's a lot. So what is the main goal of all these attacks?
Yeah, so obviously they're trying to, number one, sometimes it's vandalism. They're just trying to vandalize. They're out there just trying to break stuff for the sake of breaking to prove that they're smart. A lot of people, they have no real goal, quite frankly. It's mm-hmm. it's just pure vandalism. But most are interested in gaining some kind of access to private or, you know, a confidential information to see if there's something of value there. We call it PII, you know, personal identifiable information. If they can get, you know, addresses and social security numbers, and that's why healthcare information is so valuable, because it has so much information that is useful that usually is related to your insurance information. And even the professionals, they like those, you know, demographics of healthcare workers, because they make a little more money, they might have more resources, they could do identity theft with some of the information. So they're usually looking for those kinds of things. That tends to be, you know, really the goal is to do that. You know, it's got sophisticated out there. If you're a smart teenager and you go onto the dark web, which is the Tor browser, which I never recommend that, but you go into the Tor, you'll see that there are, you know, ransomwares of franchises. This is how sophisticated they've gotten. So you can sign up for a franchise for $299. They give you a set of hacking tools. You go out on Wi-Fi network, sit at Starbucks, maybe try to siphon credit, whatever you do. But if you get into a particular business and you hack partially in, but you can't go the rest of the way, you can escalate it with the franchise, and they'll bring in a partner, a technical partner. This is how sophisticated they are. And they'll work together to ransomware a business and then share the proceeds. So it is that sophisticated that they're trying to get data and valuable information from individuals. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John is asking again one more question about, what are top mistakes organizations make in their first and second breach that often worsen the impact? What do you think about that?
Oh, so you're talking about decisions that they make after a breach? Is that what we're talking about? I mean, so they've been breached, I guess, to understand the question. So they or make in their first or second breach that worsen the impact. I see. Okay. So mm-hmm. number one is they're not actively monitoring their network, or, you know, actively scanning for, you know, threats that are happening on their network. They react because they're so concerned about getting back up that they kind of overlook that that's their opportunity to put the right practices in place. And you spoke to this earlier. Companies will spend so much money and effort back to the kind of the budget and investment in cybersecurity. After a breach, they'll throw anything at it because they're desperate. But proactively, ahead of time, to prevent breach, they tend not to spend the money and the dollars of what it is. So again, they will tend to not isolate the systems, you know, really get to root cause of where the hack came from, where the breach came from, and then isolate, eradicate it, and then prevent it. So you really got to look at that. And there's some basic things that you look at in cybersecurity from the what we call the SOC, or the Security Operations Center, that's doing the active monitoring with the various tool sets. One of them is called MTTR, which a lot of acronyms in our world, but that's an MTTD. An MTTD is mean time to detect. Can we detect something's going on nefarious on our network within a few minutes? That's a really important metric. And then if we do, how fast can we respond? And so there's a lot of automation that we get into in those procedures where, you know, obviously AI is involved. You can now, you know, isolate much quicker, you know, and basically freeze a particular attack or stop the spread of the particular malware. There's a lot of things you do. But basically, a lot of them just failed. They delayed to basically disclose the incident. A lot of state laws, a lot of national laws will tell you that if you are breached, you've got to tell, you've got to disclose it, and you need to know what your laws are there. So that's an often mistake that can be very damaging to the business. So you're actually better off to take the hit and make sure everybody's aware what's happened and what you've done to remediate it, which means you really need to have had, you know, a remediation. You need to contain, make sure you've contained that breach, as I talked about, so that, you know, it in fact, we know it's not going to spread, and we've eradicated it, and we've prevented future, you know, attacks or various, you know, downtime or failure or whatever it might be. And then preservation of data. That's a big mistake people make when you get really involved to some of the red teams and they're getting their hands on trying to figure out what the heck to do. A lot of times it's really important not to just erase and wipe hard drives. You unplug things from the network so that you can do forensics, because that will help you make sure that in the future you truly can prevent something from happening if you truly know the root cause of what caused the breach or the malware or whatever it might be. And so that's really preserving the evidence is a pretty important thing. And then a lack of a response plan. A lot of organizations, and I spoke about this early on, really being able to say, no, we got breached, we got hacked, we know how to isolate it, we know who's going to get involved, who gets notified. We are able to respond, and we have a plan to be able to respond and follow the plan that we actually put in place. That's really important. So, yeah, communication is always a thing in times of crisis. Communication is key. Communicating with our customers, communicating internally, having other people. If we know it's starting to spread and we've got other people clicking on, bad things and causing more breach in the midst of a breach because we didn't even communicate because we're keeping a secret that there's a breach. So internal and external communications are really important. And then, I don't know, probably, blame shifting happens a lot where people try to blame different stuff and that doesn't do any good. So there's just a lot of things like that. I could go on and on, but I hope that answers some of the questions John brought up.
Yeah, I hope as well. Yeah, because I got the answer. And Scott, let's talk about AI. Can you tell how AI can impact today to cybersecurity? Because I can't avoid this topic, and any episode we usually touch AI, how AI can impact to different occupations, niches, but what about cybersecurity?
Yeah. I mean, AI is like the double-edged sword of AI. I mean, one of the things about AI and one of the things I'm working on in a new book that's actually going to be called Visible Ops AI. But I'm not just addressing it from a cyber perspective. I'm actually addressing it more from an executive perspective, because if you're not engaging AI, you are behind, right? It is the future. Yeah. You need to be using it. There's efficiencies that you gain. I am all for AI and pro AI. However, like anything, back to kind of the fool with the tool is still a fool. If you just roll out AI and you don't have governance around it, you don't know what levels of AI or it's vetted, that it's safe AI, what information you're putting in there, the ethics that AI can present, it can hallucinate and create weird stuff that's not appropriate or is irrelevant or makes you look stupid when you're trying to look smart. Just some different things in AI. So you got to be careful about that particular thing. Now, as AI relates to cyber specifically, as the threats are getting more bots and more intelligence and how they're phishing for people and all this stuff, AI can help keep up with that at a pace that, human intervention or human defenses can't. So we're using AI to be able to look for unusual login behavior, heuristics across the network, and that's partly how some of the EDR, MDR can automate its response. We're looking at insider threats, things that are happening once they're in the networks. A lot of times breaches will happen, or threat actors, they'll breach a network. They're patient. They'll wait 30, 60, 90, 6, 8 months sometimes. Matter of fact, that's part of the problem about immutable backups. They'll get in there and they'll find out where you're backing it up. You're streaming it offsite to a cloud. You think you're safe. They sit there. They learn that you're putting them off to that cloud. And if it's not fully protected, immutable, and encrypted, they'll then encrypt your backups. So it's like, oh, we got backups. We're good. We were told we got backups. No, you don't. They encrypted those as well. So they'll get you both ways. But malware identification, these are the things that AI can obviously do a really good job with. Email security, being able to look at all the glut of, spam emails and be able to isolate them, using a good security email solution is very important. As well as protecting, if you're in an Office 365 world, be able to protect those tenants. Because there's a lot of potential weaknesses in the configuration of Microsoft 365 tenants that people don't know about, and they create holes and loops that people can get in there and siphon and create relays on email and all the bad stuff you can do. So, and reducing alert fatigue. That's the other thing with AI, because it can look at false positive and know what's real and what's not real, because there's so many thousands and, firewalls, most of them will have thousands of attacks. I mean, you read stories about a guy who put up a honeypot, which is basically a firewall that's misconfigured. Up on the internet, I was reading a read story, and within 3 days, he had over 2 million attacks on that firewall. Now, that's how many bots are out there scanning. So being able to look through that information intelligently, fastly, efficiently with AI can really give you a good leg up on your defenses against the bad threat actors out there.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. Love it, love it. And Scott, I have my final question about the future of cybersecurity. I remember when, I don't remember exactly the episode, but I listened one podcast when the policeman said, we develop our technologies to catch criminals, but they developing their technologies to avoid this question. So, and I think it's the same with cybersecurity. Tools can grow, update. You mentioned about that you are going to publish a new book or update your book. So basically, you develop this or update technologies. What about the future? How do you see? I mean, like, because each year cybersecurity is growing, but the number of attacks, the number of hacked websites are growing as well. So your prediction about the future?
Yeah, so the future of cyber is, quite frankly, without being an alarmist, it's scary. And the reason it's scary is because we're all hearing about quantum computing, quantum computers that can do millions and millions and millions of transactions, very small, you know, space, you know, capability. There, it's pretty crazy. So one of the standards, kind of what's kind of been the de facto standard, is what we call 256-bit encryption. And 256-bit encryption is, you know, used to be, you know, 64-bit, 128-bit, you know, and on. So anyway, 256 the standard. What's happening now is that with the quantum computing, which is not readily available, but when the threat actors get a hold of it and the right application, what used to take a couple of years, which to potentially hack 256-bit encryption, now can do in days with quantum computing. They've proven that. It's not just theory, it's fact. It can be done. So there's a lot of things that we got to think about as quantum algorithms become more available and quantum computing. And so there's a lot of things that are technologies right now that are basically coming up with various algorithms that protect us against quantum, you know, computing. So it's basically PQC is what we call it. And I talk about this in my book a little bit, but it's quote post-quantum cryptography. So the idea is that we've got another level of cryptography beyond bit-des encryption or whatever that actually can take, you know, defend against the quantum computing algorithms. And so they can't break that. It puts it more times that things can be updated and changed, like passwords and various authentication sources. So again, it's a world of quantum computing that's coming after cyber. There's going to be a lot of people not ready. We need better, faster, quicker development of PQC, post-quantum computing algorithms. The government is investing in it. NIST, National Institute of Standards, is now coming out with some good things around both AI and PQC. So we're getting some good things that are happening around this space. But that's what people have been lookout for. It kind of sneaks up. So if you don't keep up on just the basic kind of what I'd call the basics of good cybersecurity hygiene, you better catch up with that, because you can't really have enough defense posture. You have enough practices in place, enough layers to defend against everything. You want to do your best. And then you got to get ready and keep up to date, because as the post, you know, the quantum world is coming, quantum computing, you need to have the right cryptography in place to defend and protect your system. So that's what I see as the future. AI is very much involved now. You marry AI to quantum computing and you've got a pretty dangerous, for good and for bad, right? There's a lot of good that they can do with that as well, like anything. But that's the big thing in the future, in my opinion, as we look at the future of cybersecurity. It really is the post-quantum computing algorithms to protect us against all the new quantum computing stuff and AI.
Awesome. Yeah, I love it. Thank you, Scott. A big pleasure to learn a lot of this great, valuable insights. I'm going to read your book. I recommend anyone to read your book. You know how to market this book, because you provide a lot of value before reading this book. So it gives a strong reason to read it. So tell the best way how to keep learning from you, how to reach out to you, how to follow you.
Yes. So obviously you can hit my author's website. That's probably the best place to get all my links and various things that I'm working on. That's scottaldridge.com, just like my name that's on the screen, scottaldridge.com. And you can learn more, contact me. There's a form to fill in. But I'd like to make just a couple of things I'd like to offer up.
Part of the reason
I wrote my book is basically to kind of raise the tide that floats the boats, as we say, right? Trying to, you know, altruistically help people with cyber. So one of the things is I wrote a executive guide companion to my book, because my book is 405 pages and it gets a little deep technically. But I wrote an executive guide that's really designed for, obviously, executive business owners, presidents. I would offer that book. I sell that companion guide for my cybersecurity book. It sells for $17.95, but I would offer an e-copy. My team will get you one if you text me at this number, and I'll give you the number in just a second. You'll text secure25. But I'm going to go one step further that I'm going to offer up to your audience. we use a penetration service because we can't be the ones that are managing cybersecurity for folks. And then we do the penetration scanning to say we're doing a good job. We have to have a third party that validates that's, you know, not the one that has their hands managing the security. We have a partnership and I'm willing to offer up a pen level one test. You can Google it. There were $2,000 to $5,000, $6,000, $10,000, but we'll do a pen. There's five levels of pen, but it's a pen one, which it's a great look at your network. I'm going to offer up a no cost. If you contact me with my text in a little bit, I'll give you the number, a no cost pen one test. My team will coordinate with you. It'll give you a great report that'll show you all, you know, not only just dark web stuff, but it'll show you ports and scans. It's not just a vulnerability. It really does a little penetration on your network. It's non-invasive. It doesn't affect your network. It can be done incognito. So if you think you're being told you're secure by your, you know, partners or your IT team, it'll actually check your security. They wouldn't even necessarily have to know that it's going on. So here we go. So text me if you want the book or you want a pen one scan at no charge. You text me at 541-359-1269. That's 541-359-1269. That's a USA number, a United States number. Again, secure the word or send the words secure 25. Just type in secure 25 with your number. We'll reach back out. We'll get you a book emailed out to you. We'll get you set up for a pen one scan test.
Awesome. Very generous. Yeah, guys, you can find this information in the description below if you can't write this number because you are driving or doing anything like that. So, but anyway, you can find this number. So text it, please let Scott know that you got this information on Unmiss podcast. Scott, it's a big pleasure to get on my show, to learn from you. I love so valuable. So I hope we can have this conversation one more time, you know, to keep sharing value in the future. Guys, thanks a lot for listening and watching us. See you next time.
Thank you.